the thing, because there are at least two much more competent musicians than me in house. I could just try anyway. So I'm gonna say a poem which is called my own poem called Undressing Sadness. And I'm gonna play a tune mixed up with this, which is an old Irish air called Fá Na Bóra. I was sad when she did not come to my house. Sadness became a beautiful lover. Life longing for itself, the lover inside all our other lovers. My heart was naked as a candle flame. Was a kind of bliss, a kind of beauty.
It's about 2 hours ago, so if it's a little rough around the edges, then I guess it's just like me. I call this rant number two. Rant number one came last week for any of you who weren't here. You enticed me to come to your party with the promise of cheap women and expensive beer. I cared not for the cheap women, but instead for the thought of the cold, refreshing beer tenderly touching my lips. Each sip made me more confident in my ability to talk to the girl that I'd hopefully meet at your party. I asked if I could bring a friend, and you said I could, but only if they came with a case of beer and a box of Pringles. Upon explaining that the friend, the infamous girl, with black teeth caps and bottle cap earrings, she quickly agreed that her presence was more than welcome. Having made my way up Barrack Street, past Friar Street and the Dennis Friars Walk, I finally arrived at the party. Through the open door I went, and there it was, right in front of me, right in front of my face, the biggest lie ever told to me. There was no cheap women or expensive beer, but instead there was cheap beer and great looking women. It didn't make sense. Were the people drinking cheap beer because they liked it, or because they would drink whatever they could get their hands on? This is the question that would remain unanswered. Through the hallway and into the kitchen I went, and there you were, sitting beside a tall, dark Italian stallion with an exterior as rough as the pain I endured while listening to your tales of cutting up cuts of sausages by hand, one after the other. I pretended to sympathise with you when surely I was not paying attention to you. My cute little smile was directed at you, but my eyes were elsewhere. They were looking at my friend with the black teeth cat who was just doing a ritualistic chicken dance in the corner. Suddenly I smelt the aroma emanating from beneath me. Feeling concerned, I looked down to see you removing the garlic bread slices from the oven. Any moment to expect me to tell me that you had grown the garlic yourself, made the butter in which to mix it with, and the bread upon which you were to spread it, all the while not realising that the Tesco wrapper was sitting right in front of me. Next, you regaled me with stories of how you're the only Irish person in the room, and how you felt like an outcast until I arrived. I failed to mention the fact that I was born in Australia, and so wasn't Irish either, to save you from another moment of not belonging. You left to go for a lie down, so I took my opportunity to talk to the German whose duty was to direct bathroom traffic. The line, "The bathroom on the left has a lock in it and is nicer but harder to get into," stuck in my mind. We talked for hours, and when you arose from your sleep, you found me lying on the couch with the German girl, teaching each other how to count from 1 to 10 in each other's languages. I assured you nothing was happening between us, and even paid you with shots of absence so that you would not tell my wife, however young, beautiful, suspicious of me she is. 5:30 came and I left to get a taxi home, and yes, the German girl came too. You never believed me when I said nothing happened between us, so I suspect she followed me home. For in the morning I woke to find she shaved off all my hair, placed it into a large paper bag and put a note on top of it which said, "I told your wife you were with the German girl and she asked me to do this to you." And right at the bottom was a little note which said, "P.S. Read another rant this week, I'll tell your wife that your American girl too."
Okay, thanks very much. Next up to the open mic we have Tiff Wedgbury.
And this is called Vest. You went to the party in your granddad's string vest. Called a bass guitarist with a tattoo on his chest. How jealous you made the other office girls, wasting wages on their King's Road curls. You were much more beautiful than all the rest, dancing to reggae in a gold string vest. This is called a teenage lover. Crimson lipstick and black mascara, your hair sprayed as stiff as a scouring pad. We lay together on the sofa, mum gone out and brother bribed. Love songs from the gramophone, a couple of hours on our own. The taste of martini from your sweet wet mouth. Our laughter in an echoing house. How hard to be a teenage lover, living at home with father and mother.
And next up we have David Wood. I'm sick as hell of everything that I've ever written, so I thought that I would read something that somebody else wrote. So there's a poem that a guy I know from Boston wrote named Jamie Caroline. It was written on the occasion of the death of his mother. Oh, We callous to light, dimming the beat of the machine, measuring the air you sip. Played your favorite, Jeff Buckley, Gladys Knight, Cowboy Junkie, leaned into the soft cotton of you. Like whales diving from a boat of tourists, down O2, down pressure, blood spilling to cold beam of exit signs, then a sister's tear. God, how we tried to pave that road for you. Staff back up, hands grabbing the light of your own baby. Not tonight, then. So we left. 10 minutes later, no children is witness. Gone. My Lady of All Grace. I sent you pictures of hot air balloons over the Rose Valley in Turkey. Get better. I'll be home soon. So now earth and phone calls and bless old friends who come nervous and say, remember when you came out to her? She said, you've great taste in men. She lied. My body has begun to refuse broken things. I clench fists near hospitals, sing to cemeteries, wish my shadow a good trip. The morning we opened earth, the weather hit my chest, angry dogs digging shelter. Wind set running like it had escaped from dingy backyard chains. The sun was a fool for showing its face. The night before, like a fight with a lover, hurled glass, crying for arms that will not open. My sister's voices slipped out an open window, stomachs closed in. My bones quit working. Your granddaughter, horrified, holding my jaw-pinned head up. And I want my mom, fell out like secrets told at gunpoint. Cold whiskey touches my lips, and I remember kissing your casket, leaning forward in my chair, fingers stretching long as a phone call, long as the 58 days you laid there fighting it, before I said, we'll be okay if you got someplace to be. Your daughter brought 100 balloons to the gravesite, and 100 people set them free, climbing like flames taking down a building. Locust swarm of our family saying expected things to unpredictable people. My skull knitting you back into memory of before death twisted your body into something I cannot carry. I was already packing my bags for the plane. A layover in Cincinnati, outside smoking a cigarette, too warm whiskey and so far from being able to run with you. I see a pink balloon floating up the ramp of the parking garage. Come to see me off. I've never felt so loved.
Okay, next up we have Jerry Murphy.
Put on debt. This is called Free Kick. That boy wrestler who sped through the red light at a pedestrian crossing and gave the finger to your futile protest has just slammed into a no-loader 50 meters further up the road. His severed head is rolling back down the slight incline as we speak and will soon come to a halt within reach of your right boot.
Next up we have Patricia Law. Thank you, Jennifer. This one is called Truth Hurts Less. Truth hurts less when it pierces sweetly. The layer of dark thoughts lying in wait to spring and culture at a moment's glance. and eat away problems from the inside. Oh, this one thought by use of reason, and a cold eye over the world I really loved. She checked the beast, a moment struggling. Keep the depression in its place, outside hindsight and forgive. But she rises up from a line of grave, in the center of one's soul, speaks and brave. That I greet her, for humility's sake. Then she is my sun, moon, stars, interior decorator, and advisor too. Ring to check what time I'm being at, casting a jealous glance over my work. Come sense, come people, come anything else. Truth in all its forms, help me tear down this wallpaper with the yellow rose motif, mildew and all, black to the core. Open out the windows, turn on the lights, matchsticks, candles, move about, be gods, in an orderly fashion, about this house. Maintain this romance for a while longer. From this little one, who wishes all the best, and deserves it. May the best truth. And this one is called Dad's Cabinet. Fingers on the pulse, without a quest. I'm still alive, so here we see this tableau at tea time. Slicing the afternoon into the simultaneous equations of flesh and genes, reduced to hankering at our embassies, which in his day would never have existed. What we've seen is a harboring of comedies, restricting our exports back and forth for reasons we never want to understand. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Okay, next up we have Billy Renzo.
Hi, one of the poems by MacNeice, Louis MacNeice. He used to be a poet there. Wrote the poems, never heard him. And run out the bolts, my broken comrade. Let the old seaweed crack. Let the surge burgeon oblivious to the last embarkation of feckless men. Let every adverse force converge. Here we must needs embark again. Run up the sails, my hearted comrade. Leave horizon tilt and lurch. You know the worst. Your will's fickle, your heart's impure, and your past life a ruined church. But let your poison be your cure. Put out to sea, my ignoble comrade, whose record may be noble yet. Butting through shards of moving marble, the narwhal dares us to be free. By a high star, our course is set. Our end is life. Put out to sea.
Thanks very much, Billy. Next up, Mary and Keith.
My bunny is dedicated to Manbird, who is alone, distracted on Phyllis Corner, and I wondered why. Three men stood outside the park as she walked by this morning. They were waiting for the van to take them to the building site for work. The boys were in great form, seemed they never looked so bright to them, plenty of money in their pockets with the promise of more to come. One of the men in particular was aroused by the promise of the money that would one day become his way, his friends and his plans. He also knew that in 20, 25 years, there were going to be mighty big changes, and he, Ralph Buckley, was going to be one of the movers and shakers. It wasn't going to be anyone's cup of tea, but he knew the big shots, and he was not going to be left behind. The girl walked by about 7 feet away from him, and Ralph stepped closer to her to try to catch her eye, but she kept her head down and walked on. She was young in some kind of eternal madness kind of way. There was something to dance in her hair which made a difference from all the other girls. She'd eyes were starting blue, blueness of deep sea pools that hit rocks, but also the depth of the tide. Rob felt a sudden rush through his body, under the power of self-destruction that it enveloped him. He felt that he could pick her up with his hands and break her as if she were a twig, crush and annihilate her as if she was God. A whistle from one of his two companions distracted him, and with a final look at the girl, he returned to the two boys. The man who whistled was Jack Smith, tall and lanky, about 25 like Ralph, but less ferocious looking. "Be shy, that one," he said to the world in general. "I would not say no to a piece of it," mused Magdalene thoughtfully. The third member of the group was also tall, but dark and swarthy looking. He had failed examinations and teacher training college in Limerick, and he held his grudge against the system. "She's only 16, said Jack in mock horror, and began to wrestle with Michael. "There are no jobs in the country for one like her," remarked Ralph meaningfully as he stared at the door of the pub. "She'd be in England by the time that she's 22. Jack interrupted again to stare at Ralph. "Oh, and you would know, keeping an eye on her, as if she was some broodmare. Jesus, the guards will be after you. Jesus, and who's going to tell? Is it going to be you, Jack the Lad?" laughed Ralph. "You won't get a bit of it if you decide to act like St. Kevin, the old virgin. Ah, what am I talking to you for? You would not know what to do with her." Jack stared fiercely at Ralph. He knew his mean streak, and if he gave way now, Ralph would use it against him in company unmercifully. With as much paddling as he could muster, he slurped out the words, "If I had control of that one, I would keep her in the house, and I would her until she begged me to stop. And if she complained once, I would..." Ralph's face took on a menacing look as he ran in all directions, like a chicken to squawk. "How would you do, Jackie boy? What would you do? I'd give her the belt, and then I'd give her again, the no good tinker. I'd throw my knife, I'd make her sweat and squeal like a pig." Michael turned to look at Jack, and he could not believe what he was seeing. Jack was almost spitting as he cowered in terror. Ralph was looming over him, holding Jack's gaze and licking his lips. Suddenly Ralph peeped tired again, and Michael in that split second got it in. "So what would you do, Mr. Bully Businessman Ralph Buckley?" Ralph looked for a minute as if he had been shot. The colour drained from his face, but kept his menacing expression. "Now, Michael," he said in a deceptively quiet voice, with an edge of steel to it. "We're only indulging horseplay. It's not going to harm anyone, is it? Trading all your nice manners to become the gumbean man, are you?" asked Michael with a trace of mockery in the word nice. Ralph took the measure of Michael coolly, and suddenly Michael realized that his careful word of deep insult hadn't hit Ralph at all. There was a wall there to protect him, and to get thicker and bigger to protect Mr. Ralph Buckley. Ralph had a finger up to his mouth, as if willing Michael to be silent. Then he spoke in a controlled and overly concerned voice, as if Michael was a bit slow. "Michael, would your father like to see her who raised your homestead? Your father, whose ancestors are living all over Ireland, only thinks that was just another failing of his beloved son." Michael felt hatred well up in him, and he clenched his knuckles until they were white as he shouted, "You're a murderous swine, Buckley, and you know it." Suddenly they heard a song in the air. It is the strain of "My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean." The girl was returning, and she was humming to herself. All three stood to face her. Ferocious Ralph, terrified Jack, and white knuckled Michael, and the rain began to fall.
Thanks very much, Marion. Next we have Timothy Harrington.
Thank you, Jennifer. Hey, Pegasus. Heart merged to enchant. Then Zeus, he is gone. In one lightning bolt, blowtorched sheet metal. Pre-dawn, I return to spot stars on his flanks. Hippocrene shod, wings brushing through north. Mayday 04, and if you don't like it, you can blame Jerry Marshall. I see the hand. Mayday 04. The lighthouse on Rock Island glints through the haze, like a distant white lady, toe dipped in oceanic velvet. In the lee of Ireland's southernmost point, a red sloop lies becalmed. A chill trade wind whistles through a Napoleonic signal tower, two centuries defiantly watching two nearby sheep. On behalf of a broad band of Europe, miles away, not yet kilometres, in Farmley House, 25 heads of state reach to silence every cell phone. On Browhead, no mention on the wireless of Guglielmo Marconi, whose Irish vision first brought him closer, whose acknowledged signal, like the carrier pigeon, knew no frontiers. Haiku. Tight nylon fishnets, ladders run from the bottom of hay reeks each fall. An overweight gent from Permoy, transported his fare since a boy, his imperial scales told fat weekly tales, but always in ever due pie. You are here. The metrum falls away astern. He juggles papers in a rush, bounding up the companionway, keeping to the navigable channel on the right. Lights and shapes are revisited, the task work group huddled over almanacs and symbols, parallel rulers and dividers wink at the ready. Handouts of celestial navigation make a transit of the chart room. Now before we get our bearings, a scuffle. One of the hands has hit the deck, faint. A blip of pulse, poor face, no inclination to take a sip of liquid. He is shipped out by his mates, 997 falling slowly. At 14:13 on Midsummer's Day, we undertake the tricky crossing of the busy sea corridor at the Nautical College. Visibility, good. A car is white, we swing through double doors to B block, the third waypoint. Then leaving the fountain to port, we head straight on. The sick bay lies due west. Conditions, moderating. Survivors mustered at his desk, pint in horror. Adrift in the foggy flotsam of dog-eared admiralty charts, tables of magnetic variation, instruments of exactitude, listless angles of declination, a page from the lost logbook of Christopher Columbus.
Thanks very much. And next up we have Jean.
Thanks, Jennifer. Thanks, guys, for a great reading tonight. Really enjoyed it. Last October, I was in the airport in Schiphol in Amsterdam, and suddenly I found myself in the back of an ambulance being taken away to a hospital. And fortunately came out of it, and 7 days later, at almost the same hour, I was in Rome in a restaurant with my wife, and the guy at the table next door, a man in his 80s, suddenly just keeled over, and this is a poem called Mario's. Mario's was the restaurant. There were no names exchanged in the heart of our intimacy, no common tongue, no culture. Yet I laid you down as gently as a lover does on the innocent night, carefully, considerately, and slowly. I made a pillow for you that I recklessly swiped from the nape of a nearby chair,
and opened your top button. I held your still wrist as she tilted her ear to your silence. I heard the roar from Circus Maximus that woke the sleeping Colosseum, cowered by the feast of peeping eyes that stared like admiring mothers drooling on the edge of their newborn crib. You have many mothers eyeing you now. The echoes of our journey saw helplessness as the only choice that decorated the multitude of tables. I drew within and sucked the sober gnaw of light that bit me in its ambush just the shortest week ago. There was no religion, blessing, caressing, or bargaining then. Playback's cue stood promiseless as I placed my clasped hands upon your season-ending chest and felt the matrimony of our destinies. Mea maxima culpa. She placed her lips on yours, knees as a dedicated plumbing fixture, and fed you while I fractioned the still life scene. A camouflage of gawking mouths poked themselves through future party stimulants. Your feedback refused to deliver itself, and I slid back to a sinking time in my innocent youth when silence said it was all over. All off. The end of the relation. The feeding of the unforgiving lump. Her wasted tidal volume, she selflessly infused again, more intimately than the seasoned lover's whisper to the spark of their lovemaking. I pushed her sternum with the determination of a tight end on the 5 meter. I am Caesar, I am Claudius, I am Nero, I am a gladiator, and she is every queen that dressed your ancient city. She whose mirrored soul I swim in is God in a land of many gods and gives you life and love to keep. Take it. The twinning of your opening eyes and her welcome announcement that indeed you drew a breath of life broadcast the beat of relief that fed the multitude and stacked the sighs and waiting to be broken promises. Were you and I the chosen slaves, saved to fight another day, and truly the only ones who met the quencher of the wit? We who saw the polishing of the parlor. Are we refugees borrowing from that time, or masticators of prematurity?
Poem actually will be published this Friday, and I have a second poem here that was published in the States last week called Closed Line, and I'd like to read it for any separated fathers who are here tonight. When I separated, the simplest of things could be the cruelest of things, and for me hanging out the washing was a very difficult thing, because from hanging out the washing for 6, you were hung out for 1, and when you looked left and right, there was families of washing winking at you. So the poem is called Close the Line, and it's for separated fathers. I would walk to my gallows once weekly, and feed the rope with single men, and witness the gawking families unilaterally waving the many colours of unity's insults. They would do it without speaking or moving, without even knowing the pain they had infused, marrow-bound, a line of useless groans out of sync with family matters. Us was parked in every garden that wasn't ours, dancing all day in winds that ceased to live, in what seemed to be the only lifeless garden, rainbows of stories sticking out their tongues. We never did the feeding of the nylon, nor the retrieving of the cleansed. Eyes set down from conversations at both boundaries that were linked to what we now knew as a family. Everybody beyond our ditches seemed to gel with the laughter of coal bunkers and barbecues, to continue the unfinished over the flapping icons that waved them inside their capitals. Thank you.
Next we have Niall Herring.
First one is Full Circle. There's not much to be said about this by way of introduction. Reality is what we take to be true, like this damn M50 traffic jam. Truth is what we believe in. He believes he needs to take a leak. Belief is based on what we perceive. He perceives the fullness in the abdomen. Perception relates to what we focus on. He focuses on a bladder that feels like bursting. Focus depends on what we think about. He thinks about all those coffees that he drank. Thought depends on what we perceive. He perceives a tiny trickle in his trousers. Perception is based on what we believe. He believes faces look down from that bus. Belief determines what we take to be true. If I either piss himself or be a flasher. Our truth for each of us is our reality. It's rush hour at the toll gates on the M50. I may have read this one here before, or may not, but anyway, I like to dust it off at this time of year. Sylvan Soundscape. And I have to acknowledge Jerry Murphy in the first phrase. Not blame, it's actually acknowledgement, yeah. In my mind's ear, avian, that's the Jerry Murphy. In my mind's ear, avian stories unfolding in beech trees. Raucous cause of football hooligans. Sonnets sung to nesting loved ones. A xenophobic complaint at my intrusion. A jazz piano suitor on the wings. The china teacup set, tut-tutting at all this carry-on from behind leafy curtains. A charm of notes. Exuberant, cascading, in homage to spring. And I'd like to finish up with Protean Questions, which is dedicated to an old friend who's passed on. Gwyn Davis, a Welshman, a marine biologist, philosopher. And the poem is inspired by some of his thinking. Blue and white shimmering jewel, spinning in the ink black ether. Planet with uncertain future. The master species, not yet sapiens, holds your destiny in the balance. Your restless oceans are the key. Protean, primeval, source of life. Cradle there the alchemist's stone. The solar furnace warms the oceans, breathing energy into our world. Radiant richness, plankton teeming, powering the delicate web of life, which humankind with love can nurture, or destroy through greed and strife. Wise old Proteus, the prophetic sea god, Poseidon's servant whose dolphin friends in the ancient fable you were said to tend, the many shapes you can assume to avoid being forced to prophesy, symbols of alternate futures that now before us darkly lie, nuclear poison and greenhouse gases, or thermal power from ocean storehouse, famine, disease, children wasting, or protein nurtured in Poseidon's garden, for needs, not greed, on earth at last. Proteus has said he will tell the future if mankind drops fear and grips you fast. Thank you.
To Alan, God knows who you were talking about, but I'm glad you said that the week before I'm MC. So
I love you too.
This is about, I never ever had a good school report. I don't know whether this will explain why I never did, even to the point where I used to try and hide them, but the mother would always find them. So this is why I never got a good school report. My school report. Needs to pay more attention and could do with less talking. Has the habit of holding back others. Has been talkative is her main thing. Talks way too much, spends more time doing this than studying, and would really need to get into touch. While she has ability and is well-mannered, her antics get her into trouble. If these were put aside and asserted herself, then her potential she would be able to fulfill. However, I was not bad-mannered or rude. I never really broke school rules, and my grades were always good. personally, I think that I was just being misunderstood. Getting sent to the principal and other teachers happened to me a lot. I remember being sent to the head because I repeatedly told the careers teacher I wanted to be the first Tyrone astronaut. Going to a Catholic secondary school, they were all very uptight. When asked once what was the best method of contraception, my answer was not regular. At the top of my voice and with confidence, I answered, "Withdrawal, sir." Well, you can imagine the teacher's face full of shock and rage. Speaking out of turn, derived in my constant primary school days, I feel, when asked by Sister Gertrude to say the prayer after me, loudly I said, "Holy Mary, Mother of God, rub-a-dub-dub and thanks for the grub." And that is why my ears stick out as they do. As a 14-year-old, we were still meant to be reading Twinkle and Bunty, comics you read when you were 10. But I was caught in the maths class reading a magazine with an Artigan saying I'd slept with over 100 men. I was marched off to the religion teacher and was told I should be ashamed. I think I'm still being used as an example of wrongness and I'm still being named. And I remember a letter being sent home and being killed by my ma and da because for a religion assignment about iconic figures I wrote about all the members of the RA as a joke, but they didn't see the funny side. But I still got my grades in GCSE and A-levels and I surprised them all, and despite never having a good school report I wouldn't change it because I always had a ball.
I mentioned her as the resident pub poet. I realised there's an announcement I failed to make. Our actual OVL resident poet gives workshops every Saturday, I believe it is, and they're resuming this Saturday. So if you have any interest in that, can you come speak with Paul and he can give you the details. They're really excellent workshops on using voice, your voice during reading. Obviously, I'm not the one teaching it. Okay. Thanks very much. Next up to the open mic, Pat Cutter.
Angus's dream.
Yes.
Sorry. The undreamt life is not worth living. Witness Angus, desolate and isolated, although all loved him, favourite son, cherished for beauty, kindness, wit. One glimpse of delight ne'er stubbed him out. He dreamt he washed slowly and carefully in a river of molten silver and clambered out, dripping moon reflection. Reflected also was the moon in a girl's eyes, in the glow on her breast. Her hair was so bright it was a mystery. Was it a source of light like a flame or a sharer of light like gold? Her breaking smile wiped clean his brain. A smiling girl, so slender, so beautiful, sitting beside the shadow of a yew. How she stared. Her eyes had an appetite which said, "Oh, how I like what I see, handsome man. How wonderful your presence, how peaceful your strength, how strong your silence." When he started awake, one small white feather shuddered off his chest. It is only a dream, but it recurred nightly without mercy. All his waking hours he vainly charged his wits to draft an image of the girl as vivid as in his sleep. He rode each day hopelessly in all directions, as far as his horse could carry him, to meet her, to touch. Soon the grief grumbling in the pit of himself blent with the writhings of hunger. Honeyed oatcakes and meat dipped venison, green fowl, as his body wasted. All he could do was lie still in bed, thinking of her and her smile, feeling the flesh drip from his bones like pig's fat on a roasting stick. Each morning a white feather was plucked from his chest. He told no one of his dream, his wasting was a mystery. Druids intoned incantations. They fingered his body from scalp to heel, searching for growths in the wartings of revengeful spirits. Nothing deterred his wasting. In his dreams he was still a strong and purposeful man, striding out of the waters in front of her, while awake he had not the power to roll from his own cot. Fern is a physician of coup to his cause. He with the gift of scrutinizing a settlement stream and deciding and deducing how many there were ailing. A mere glimpse of a man's face revealed to him the root of his disease. He knew men morbid with love for their brother's wife, or even their stepmother, he insisted on speaking to Angus alone. "Who is this woman you love?" Angus spilt his story like milk from a goat's teeth. The stream, the hue, the girls, the feathers. Furley knew as soon as sure as his own heartbeat, this girl had to be. No pure dream wasted men. I had no time to tell how Ferna found the girl, not enough breath to tell the lengthy tales of bloodletting or of the trickery that stood between Angus and the girl whose name was Coir. Coir was the daughter of Ethel an Buail. Only after 60 of his men had heads hacked from their shoulders, only after Aliel and Maeve of Connacht threatened to unravel his own neck to ragged sinews, did Ethel confess how she was not his for the giving, how he was powerless over his own self-willed daughter. She would be amenable to a man just before altering herself to the form of a white bird. In this form she stayed all year, every second year. Angus was told to greet her on the first day of the following Samhain, when Cahir would change. At Loch Beldrakken, Cahir was there, looking as she did in his dreams, a tall, sinuous girl of delicate breasts, with hair of waterfalling gold, and skin so pale, so like vellum, it glowed with the redness of her own blood. When the sight of him filled her eyes, her face was as rapt as in his dreams. "Come and sit with me, Cahir," he called. "And what is your name, brazen man?" "Angus." There was not one stirring of real distrust. "I will only come to you if you let me return afterwards to the water." He knew her enchantments were strong. He could never win her by trickery or force. In truth, she was his already. She came to him. For 3 days and 3 nights they lay beside the lake, by the lake side, in a swan's wide net, their readings echoing birds' lush work. After the 3rd night they went to the water and altered into swans, spans broad as an army's flank. Cahir clung to Angus thereafter. The rest of their lives they spent changing from swans to gods and back. They stayed forever enthralled and never grew tired of the sight or touch or taste of each other.
Whoever they represent as bad name or whatever. I suppose this is sort of just about consultants or whatever, and I suppose all kind of innocent med students or whatever, they usually go in for the right reason to, well, they, you know, save their lives or whatever they think, and it's a delusion of me. But anyway, this is just a reminder so that they don't, you know, kind of lose perspective of what they're going to do for them. Names will turn to numbers, just that in which you will slumber, thinking constantly how to impress. Infallible now, you will always know how, and errors will be somebody else's. White coat like a toga, you will talk of condos and yoga, and get parachurized better than cannabis. Preaching, dictating, undermining, delegating, and still all those around you with stamping. Consumed by your money, with your life so funny, you have lost all feelings of gratitude. May you rue the day that people say, her car is as big as her attitude. This is just about people kind of locking up emotions or whatever, it's called the secret room. Scratching hits me like a bright idea, the sorrow soaked until I'm full. But a hunger lingers year in year, a famished soul and crumbs. And a storm from which no good can come, a course alone and dark I lead. Sitting rain upon my soul and my home, what makes the storm recede? Like a creature in a cage that shrinks, as it no longer grows, the bars to which I reach a hand, gotten far too close. But, as I lie in bed asleep, I'll dream away the gloom, lock up all emotions, secrets keep. Tomorrow I'll lock them in my room. This one's called Sleep On, for any problems. Before the intellect, that instinctive whip, your unconscious knows you best. Put all the memos and stress underneath your mattress. Let solutions be fine with your rest. We have Brian, is it Brian McElroy?
Hello. Thanks very much to everyone for this night. Fantastic. Thanks for sharing with everyone. I just have a couple of quotations that I'd like to read. This from a guy called William Blake. To see a world in a grain of sand, and the heavens in a world saw. Hold infinity in the palm of your hand, and eternity in an hour. And second quote is by Confucius, and it is easier today to triumph over evil habits than it will be tomorrow. Thank you.
Just a reminder that we do record the open mics on an MP3 that's available online at the ovale.ie website. But if you would like your reading to be omitted, you can talk to myself or Paul and it can be edited out. So is there anybody else who at the last minute has decided that they would like to read? Okay. Well, I wouldn't normally do this, but I do have a friend who came from California, so I'll play you with this one short piece. It's called Changeability. Clouds are formed from his small grievances, gravid drops floating above daily outer life, like going to the store for bread, like driving children home. This is how rain works. Your sins are at a maximum capacity and their collective body gives. Sheeting down gray blankets, making veils of clingy hair, testing the integrity of skin as an organ of protection. Soaked, you can dry, you can conjure fires, but there remains a skeletal cold. A cord structure shivering after his unprovoked baptism. Thanks very much. Okay, thanks for all your brilliant readings tonight, and I believe, as tradition, there is the Crane Lane afterwards. Take care. See you next week.